Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is conflicts to watch in 2019. With me this week to look at the year ahead and to discuss the conflicts that might dominate the news in 2019 is Paul Stairs. Paul is the General John W. Vesey Senior Fellow for Conflict Prevention and Director of the Center for Preventive Action here at CFR. He is also the author of Preventive Engagement, How America Can Avoid War, Stay Strong, and Keep the Peace. Paul and the Center for Preventive Action just released their annual Preventive Priorities Survey, which you can find at cfr.org. The survey, now in its 11th year, asks experts to rank 30 ongoing or potential conflicts based on their likelihood of occurring or escalating in the next year and their potential impact on U.S. national interests. Paul, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Jim, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year. Good to see you. Hope you had fun holidays.
Yes, it was good.
Relaxed to come back and work hard.
To consider these depressing topics.
Well, let's jump in. I guess maybe the best way to start off is giving people a little bit of background on how the Preventive Priority Survey is done and what it seeks to tell us.
Okay, so this is actually the 11th year that we've done this. And so at the end of each year, we solicit recommendations for inclusion in the survey that we send out at the end of the year to several thousand foreign policy experts in America. And we ask them, you know, which crises or conflicts do you think could deteriorate or escalate in the coming year? And we pull together all the suggestions, we put them into 30 contingencies, which we think are plausible in the coming year, not destined to escalate or break out, but are plausible. And then we send it out to the experts and we ask them to do two things, assess the likelihood and secondly, the impact on U.S. interests. And that part is actually, I think, makes this survey unique, actually. And very few people actually try to assess what the impact on U.S. interests.
So there are two dimensions here. One
exactly.
is likelihood. The other is, in some sense, importance or significance.
Yes. It's a classic kind of risk assessment methodology. And the idea behind it, or the logic behind it, is that no one crisis is equally important to others. We have to make choices, and it's better to do this in a sort of rational way, not only in terms of likelihood but impact. And policymakers are busy; they can only devote much time, and so they have to prioritize. And the survey is designed to help them choose where to focus their attention.
And you're specifically interested in U.S. policymakers,
absolutely.
Given the focus here is on the impact on U.S. interests.
That's right. Now, we often get suggestions to include other types of conflicts or crises, humanitarian crises, economic ones, environmental, natural disasters, but we very much focus just on crises that could potentially draw in the U.S. in terms of military intervention. They're the ones that most concern
us. So we're not talking whether the global economy is going to tank in 2019 or whether there'll be a tsunami somewhere that will cause the world to mobilize. We're talking about violent conflict.
Yeah, and it's not to diminish the importance of those other events. It's just to really focus on those where the risk of conflict could increase.
Well, fair enough. I just want to make sure we sort of understand what we're talking about in doing this survey. So you've, again, done this now. This is the 11th year. When the experts are looking out at 2019 from the vantage of the last months of 2018, what is the sort of wisdom, what's the insight that they want to share? What is it that we're particularly worried about in 2019?
So I can certainly point to several takeaways here that when I look at the results. And one is in terms of threats to homeland security, the risk of a cyber attack against U.S. critical infrastructure, you know, health systems, power systems, banking systems, that I think now for the second year has supplanted the fear of a kind of another 9/11 attack. What is remarkable, though, is that 17 years after 9/11, there is still quite considerable concern over another mass casualty terrorist attack against the U.S. But most experts worry about cyber these days, it seems, when it comes to homeland security. The other interesting takeaway was that, you know, we're regularly told that this is we're moving into an era of great power confrontation and rivalry, and China and Russia are going to be our geopolitical threats in the coming years. But of all the contingencies that were ranked, only one involving U.S. and China made it into the top tier, the very highest tier of.
Okay, explain for us when you talk, because the survey breaks the scenarios or contingencies into three tiers.
That's right.
Top tier is one.
So we aggregate the scoring of likelihood and risk into three tiers, and tier one, tier two, tier three. And the tier one has the highest likelihood matched with the highest impact on U.S. interests. And only one contingency involving the U.S. and China, and specifically South China Sea, made it into tier one. Whereas you would think all the concern about Russia's interference in our electoral systems and other parts of the world, that Russia would be also highly ranked. But most of the experts we polled, Russia was considered a tier two concern, which is a surprise to me.
Now, I'm just sort of curious, because just given the news, not just the issues of Russian interference in American elections, if I understand correctly, Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats has suggested that the Russians tried to meddle in the 2018 congressional midterm elections. But you also have the issue of increased Russian activity in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. We had the clash, obviously, the seizure of Ukrainian naval vessels, three of them, I believe, mm-hmm. I guess the beginning of November. So any intuition as to why people don't place that to the prospect of a confrontation with Russia higher on the list?
It could have something to do with the timing of the survey. The seizure of Ukrainian sailors just off the Crimean coast occurred right after the end of the survey, and it's possible that had the survey been extended, then Russia would have, and Ukraine conflict in particular, could have received a higher ranking. So I suspect that had something to do with it. Looking ahead, though, I think Ukraine is definitely a flashpoint to worry about. We have national elections, presidential elections coming up in March, I believe, of this year in Ukraine. And
looks like a rerun. It's going to feature the incumbent president against the person he defeated,
yes.
Was it 4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah, deja vu all over again. And so we could see some real tensions there. There's been reports of Russians building up their forces on the border and increasing naval pressure. They haven't returned the Ukrainian sailors that they seized in that incident, and there's a lot of pressure on them to do so from Europeans at the moment. So that's definitely a potential flashpoint.
Paul, let's actually talk about some of the specific scenarios and potential conflicts to keep an eye out on for 2019. And let's begin with conflicts among great powers, mm-hmm. since those obviously have the greatest potential to cause harm and death. And let's, I guess, begin with U.S.-China relations. You noted that one scenario that made it into the tier one mm-hmm. in your survey of potential conflicts is something arising out of a confrontation in the South China Sea mm-hmm. between the United States and China. Sort of walk us through what that confrontation would be over, how it might start, and to what extent you think that's something that we should be worried about.
So there are various territorial features, small islands or coral reefs that in the South China Sea, and China has claimed them as part of their own sovereign territory, and this is disputed by other countries in the region, some of whom are allied with the United States, Philippines in particular. This is also a major waterway in which a huge proportion of the globe's trade passes through. And
yeah, I see suggestions that one quarter of the world's trade passes
absolutely.
Through this region.
So this is a vital artery of the global economy. And the U.S. has had a longstanding interest in preserving freedom of navigation in these areas and ensuring that nobody can restrict these vital arteries. And some time ago, China started seizing these uninhabited areas and militarizing them, contrary to their...
They've channeled their inner Netherlands. They've become Dutch, actually outdoing the Dutch in terms of reclaiming land from the water.
They've been dredging up the local sand, building them into actual military outposts, contrary to their promises not to do so. And this has alarmed many people in the region. And while it's unlikely that the U.S. would try to recover or capture these islands, the possibility of an unintended conflict with U.S. naval forces or allied naval forces and with the U.S. coming to their aid is ever present.
Well, because the United States insists that these remain international seas in which they are allowed under customary and actual international law to sail through. And the Chinese say, no, these are our islands and we claim exclusive rights around those islands.
That's exactly right. And there's believed to be hydrocarbon deposits, there's fishing areas nearby too. So,
but that's more important to countries in the region. The United States is not making claims to hydrocarbon in the area.
So that is a possibility, although it's hard to imagine, frankly, that one can see a full-scale war arising out of this. But certainly a major incident that pitched China against the United States, that could sort of act as a kind of tipping point in the U.S.-China relationship in the future. It could put us on a more confrontational trajectory.
Context, we already are in a more confrontational trajectory. I mean, the Trump administration has named China as a strategic competitor, and we're in a situation in which we are in what's clearly the beginning, it may be the end, of a trade war with China, depending upon whether a deal's worked out. But it's taking place in which there is a lot more hostility going across the Pacific than there was in the past.
Mm-hmm. So besides the South China Sea, though, I think the potential conflict to look for in the future is over Taiwan. This is a long-standing issue, obviously, between China and Taiwan.
And how would you summarize that conflict? What is at stake here between Taiwan and China?
So China sees Taiwan as part of the mainland and part of larger China, and the defeated nationalist forces at the end of the Chinese Civil War at the end of the 1940s retreated to Taiwan, and they've always maintained that they're not part of China and or do not recognize the authority of the Communist Party over mainland China. But China itself has strongly emphasize that any attempt at formal independence, political independence, would be resisted by China. In fact, Xi Jinping in his New Year speech again reiterated longstanding Chinese wishes for reunification and for closer ties, and that any attempt at separation, formal separation from the mainland, could even be met with force.
Did you take Xi's speech to mark a change in Chinese policy? Is this the beginning of China ratcheting up the tension on Taipei, or is this just what you would expect any Chinese leader to say, and basically we should approach it as nothing to see here?
So the experts that watch this closely say that there really isn't much that's different in terms of the content of Xi's remarks. But I think the tone is somewhat different. And he's staked a lot of his own political standing on resolving this issue. And he sees it as sort of China's destiny to reunite the country and he is, as I say, staked his personal status on resolving this issue.
And I'll note the Chinese economy has been slowing down recently, and a number of experts suggest that it's going to slow down a lot more, and potentially you could see a major recession or financial crisis, and that potentially, I would imagine, could change how Xi views Taiwan. It may sort of up for him the need to press ahead on Taiwan to satisfy, build up national support if he can't deliver on the economic side of the house.
Right. And while it's still some way off, there are elections in Taiwan in 2021, and one could imagine that if candidates run on a more sort of independent, separatist line, that will bring a predictable opposition.
Right. I think it's important to keep in mind then that the Taiwanese have a say in how this is going to evolve, yes. And there is an independence movement on Taiwan. How strong it is and whether it will appear in the next election is up in the air. And also, obviously, what it is that the United States does in terms of Taiwan. Congress, this in 2018, passed legislation that, in essence, upped America's commitment to Taiwan, an issue which I think was taken note of in Beijing.
Yes, and it's been a balancing act for the United States for a long time to show support for Taiwan, to insist that this issue be resolved peacefully, and that, but at the same time, that any attempt by China to impose its will on Taiwan, especially by force, will be resisted.
Right. And obviously, the flip side of it is anytime the United States acts to try to demonstrate its commitment to Taiwan, that may be the signal being sent, but the signal being received could be this is a provocation. The Americans are trying to change the current status quo, and that's unacceptable. Let's sort of move further up the region. Let's talk about an issue that I think for most people, if we had sat down at the end of 2017, we would have said was going to be the defining issue of 2018, and that's North Korea's nuclear weapons program. We've now had the Singapore summit in which a lot of promises were made. President Trump came back when he touched down at Andrews Air Force Base last summer, said he solved the problem. He subsequently said that he loves
Kim Jong-un.
So when we look at potential conflicts in 2019, how do we think about North Korea?
So you're absolutely right, Jim. This time last year, all the talk of fire and fury, I think that was the term that the president used.
My button's bigger than your button.
Exactly. And I think that was certainly the number one concern of last year's survey. And while the rhetoric is clearly dialed down and the prospect of conflict has definitely lessened, the fact that, and I think this was borne out by the results of the survey, the fact that we haven't really progressed in any significant way in bringing about denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula, despite the commitments of both sides to move ahead with that.
Well, when the United States says denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, what it means is North Korea gives up its nuclear weapons.
Absolutely.
When the North Koreans talk about denuclearization, they're talking about any country, or all countries taking away nuclear weapons, and
Absolutely.
They mean the United States.
And that is the heart of this problem. And it's hard to see how the different interests here can be reconciled in the coming year. So it's quite possible that we could see a return to increased tensions and bellicose rhetoric if the North Koreans refuse to move ahead in any way or start to test again their missile systems or their nuclear systems, then we're back to where we were a year ago.
But if I take what President Trump said after the Singapore summit, he seemed to communicate that he had been bluffing with his threats of using military force because it would obviously lead to a calamity on the North Korean peninsula. So how would that play out?
So you're right. He, in some respects, he's undermined the credibility of future threats that might have to be used, and the economic pressure on North Korea from sanctions is also lessened too. He believes that there will be another summit with Kim Jong-un sometime in the spring that will resolve all these issues. It's hard to believe, frankly, how the very different sets of interests that play here can be reconciled. The North wants sanctions removed first, and we want them to denuclearize first. And so who goes first here, and how do you compromise on this very delicate problem hasn't been really thought through.
Let's go further west, go to the Middle East, which over the last two decades has given the world more than its share of conflicts. As you look at 2019 and survey what's happening in the Middle East, what concerns you? What are you worried about?
So the Middle East, again, is the region of the world that is most prominent in the survey. I think there are seven or eight contingencies or potential crises mentioned this year. So there's no source of anxiety over the Middle East. If I were to focus on three or four particular areas of concern, I would look first at Syria. We had the recent announcement by the president that he was withdrawing the U.S. forces from northeast Syria.
Last couple of days, at least some people are coming away from meetings with him claiming that he's now going to slow that down.
So it was originally going to be 30 days. Now there's talk of 4 months. I think the president is pretty adamant, unless something changes on the ground, that he's going to pull back the U.S. forces. And so will that embolden the Assad regime to reimpose control over those areas? Will it embolden the ISIS, this terrorist group that still exists in parts of northeast Syria, to regain the initiative? Will it act as a green light to Turkey to strike the Kurdish forces that we've been allied with to try to defeat ISIS? All this could cause a resumption of conflict.
You left out one other thing, which is the intensification of Iran's presence in Syria and completing what appears to be a long-held goal of Tehran, which is to build a corridor going all the way to the Eastern Mediterranean.
Iran is definitely a player here, as is Israel too. Mm-hmm. And people forget or maybe not appreciate how often Israel has struck Iranian forces inside Syria to degrade Iranian influence in Syria. And that is a definite sort of conduit for escalation too.
And to this point, it's happened with the Russians essentially not coming to the support of the Iranians, looking the other way.
Right.
As it happened, the question is whether that will persist. You know, there are a lot of different governments here with interests.
Right. So besides Syria, the situation regarding Iran, as you mentioned, I think is another potential flashpoint. The U.S. is reimposing sanctions now on Iran, and they're going to start biting. In fact, I think they already are in terms of prices inside Iran, which could lead to unrest. That might also lead the government of Iran to engage in activities to try to take pressure off Iran, to distract the people from the situation there. Iran has played some role inside Yemen, this horrific situation in Yemen too. And so we could see Iran trying to, as I say, deflect attention, to try to relieve pressure on itself as a result of these sanctions and other activities. So Iran is definitely one. I mentioned Yemen. There is some prospect that we will see progress in these sort of back-channel negotiations that are taking place. There was a ceasefire announced, I think, on Christmas Day, in fact, over the port of Hodeidah on the Red Sea to allow humanitarian supplies to get into Yemen. It's just a horrible famine, and women and children dying. It's just horrific. But again, this is a really tough challenge to reconcile the different interests, and so Yemen could get worse before it gets better.
And one of the interesting things there in terms of thinking about consequences for the United States is that people have some legitimate differences over the extent to which U.S. interests are at stake at these places. I mean, going back specifically to Syria, I mean, the president's announcement that he was going to pull U.S. troops out clearly signaled that he thought the impact on U.S. interest was minor or non-existent, which is quite different than the viewpoint held by General Mattis, Secretary of Defense, who resigned over this issue. So it's I think, important always to keep in mind that interests are subjectively defined rather than objective facts.
And a lot of Middle East experts actually don't disagree with the president on this and feel that we don't have vital interests there now that ISIS is more or less defeated, and that our presence there really doesn't achieve much. And most of the criticism was the manner in which he announced this. It was sort of very abrupt and unannounced.
Yeah, well, maximize the costs and minimize the benefits.
Right.
And I think a lot of the critique was that. It came as a shock to some of our closest friends. Mm-hmm. There was no detailed plan for stepping down, and he didn't trade it for anything.
Absolutely.
And that he could have used it to have gotten assurances or commitments from the Russians or the Syrians or others.
Yes.
And that didn't happen.
That's right.
Let's come all the way back to the Western Hemisphere, because, you know, obviously the one country that has featured a lot in talks about foreign policy conflicts over the years is Venezuela, mm-hmm. Which continues to go through an epic economic social collapse. In each year, as I sit and talk to people who are experts in the area, they say this is the year something has got to change because it's gone too far. What do you see happening in Venezuela?
So you're absolutely right, Jim. You know, the dog has been barking, the proverbial dog's been barking about Venezuela for many years now. And it's also one of our top tier places to watch in the survey this year. I think the biggest concern is not just the plight of people inside Venezuela, which has just worsened over the years. You know, critical medical supplies, food, and so on are in short supply, and the economy is pretty much collapsed. The main issue is the outflow of migrants.
People are voting with their feet and leaving.
Absolutely. And the UN says around 3 million have already departed. They calculate another...
That's about 10% of the population.
Yep. And about another... They estimate another 2 million will leave this year. The current rate is around 5,000 a day. It's down a little bit, but one can imagine the situation worsening to the extent that more people decide to leave. And that's putting pressure on Colombia, on Peru, on Brazil. And you just think that at some point something's got to give. And the question is, what can we do about it? There's a real allergy to intervening, certainly militarily, to settle this issue, to changing the regime in Caracas. So what can be done other than hoping to help the plight of the average Venezuelan with humanitarian aid? And it frankly will require, I think, concerted action from leaderships in the region. Maybe the new Mexican president will play a more decisive role.
I find that hard to believe. It seems to me Mr. Lopez Obrador is very much focused on things at home and wants to pursue a non-interventionist foreign policy. I think the more interesting person to watch is Mr. Bolsonaro, the new president of Brazil, given that Brazil shares a border and, as you noted, is feeling the spillover of the conflict.
But he too has internal issues, and I think, you know, if there's a kind of motif for the current era we live in, everyone's looking to deal with their own problems, and there isn't a lot of public support or domestic constituents in any country to settle any major issue until it becomes unbearable. And so,
well, I think clearly here, everyone is looking for somebody else to do something,
yeah,
and
absolutely.
No one seems so inclined. And the U.S., for historical reasons, is not well positioned. Let me just close, Paul, with are there any other conflicts or potential conflicts that people should keep an eye out on for 2019? Any conflicts that you think people aren't thinking about right now that may provide us with ugly surprises?
Yeah, there's always something that comes out of left field and surprises everybody. And we always try to think about this. In fact, we ask respondents to the survey to sort of write in their suggestions. And, you know, one of the more surprising offerings this year was domestic unrest in the United States as a result of of either unhappiness with President Trump's policies or right-wing violence, white supremacy violence. And
well, that clearly has been on the upswing.
Absolutely.
Right-wing violence.
And that's hardly a foreign policy challenge, although it does affect, I think, U.S. standing in the world. So I guess I am worried about instability here. Afghanistan, that could come back onto the front pages. There's going to be an election here this year. There's peace talks with the Taliban. I think that's also reaching a point where the level of domestic support in this country is so low now that I can see us possibly pulling out too.
Well, President Trump seems to be sending that signal. I mean, he, in his announcement in August 2017 about providing a small increase in U.S. troops in Afghanistan, said at the time that he was going against his gut. His gut was to leave, but he was willing to do it because he had a plan for victory. It's become clear since then that the United States doesn't have a plan for victory. We were kind of hoping to use the troop increase to force the Taliban to the negotiating table, but the Taliban can read the newspapers as well as anybody else, and why should you concede when you're winning on the ground? It looks like your opponent is going to go home. So
right. That's exactly right.
And the future for Afghanistan, I think, if the United States pulls out, will be pretty bleak.
Yes, I couldn't agree more, Jim.
Okay. On that sobering note, we're going to close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Paul Stairs. He is the director of CFR's Center for Preventive Action. And he and CPA have just released the 11th Annual Preventive Priorities Survey, which you can find on CFR.org. Also going along with it is its companion piece, the Global Conflict Tracker, the GCT, which provides a lot of information on conflicts around the world and is updated on a regular basis. So it can give you sort of the latest news on conflicts or incipient conflicts around the world. So Paul, thank you for joining me today.
And thank you, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Opinions expressed on the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guest, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazzo with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Sydney Burton was our recording engineer. Thanks, Sydney. Special thanks go to Corey Cooper and Gabrielle Sierra for their assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.